Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald & Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, yes, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers, professionals, and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're talking with two professionals from JGL's personal injury department about a topic that is particularly timely, litigation and the COVID virus. Can you sue for acquiring COVID? And to help us talk a bit about that, we've got two folks from JGL. Celeste Cunningham is a senior litigation paralegal with Joseph Greenwald & Lake. She obtained her associate's degree in paralegal studies from the College of Southern Maryland in 1996 and began working in personal injury insurance defense. In 1999, she joined a firm specializing in plaintiff's personal injury work and workers' compensation. She joined JGL in December of 2002 and has been the supervisor of the firm's personal injury department for the last several years. Matt Vogt is a senior counsel and a trial lawyer in JGL's personal injury practice group. Matt works with individuals who have been injured in avoidable accidents and helps them to recover compensation for their injuries, loss of income, and other damages. Matt is a member of the bar in Maryland and the District of Columbia. Matt and Celeste, thank you guys for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having us, Dave. Appreciate it.
So let's start with the big question, which is the overriding topic here. Can people file a lawsuit if, in fact, they acquire COVID?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, people can file lawsuits for all sorts of things. The better question is, can you win a lawsuit if it's based in acquiring or contracting COVID? And the answer, like almost everything else that we do in the law, is that it depends. It depends where you are and it depends on the circumstances. So because COVID is such a new phenomenon, the best way to look at it is to look at your sort of the basic concepts of negligence, the building blocks of what do you need to prove in a negligence case. And the basics are that you need to be able to prove a breach of the standard of care and you need to prove causation. And when you look at standard of care, you don't not only looking at whether there was a violation there, you have to establish what the standard of care is, what duty is owed to you as the person who's making the claim. So generally, if we're thinking about sort of the classic cases of a slip and fall or a car accident, things like that, generally, a premises owner or a landlord owes a duty of reasonable care to keep a premises safe. So, you know, things like not having puddles of water in the grocery store or having a smushed up green bean on the floor of the produce section. You know, those sorts of things, if there's notice of that hazard, the landlord or the premises owner has a duty to rectify them. They have the duty to mop up the floor. They have the duty to pick up the smushed up green bean to keep their shoppers and the people who are what are called invitees to the store reasonably safe. Now, they're not a guarantor of safety. In other words, they're not saying there is no chance that you'll never get injured at our grocery store or in our restaurant or what have you, but it's what is reasonable. And I think Celeste is uniquely positioned to talk about this because in our own firm and in our own office, we've looked at the question of, okay, what steps do we reasonably have to take to keep our folks in our office safe? And we established a committee to look at that question. And Celeste was on that committee, and I think it would be a good time for her to talk about what did they look at and what did they come up with as to the types of reasonable steps that a prudent office would take to keep folks safe from COVID as we start to reopen offices and bring people back into the workplace.
So Celeste, let me ask you a preliminary question before you get into that. Is when we talk about a premises owner and someone who has a responsibility to people coming onto the premises, who are we talking? We talk about not just landlords, we talk about employers and people, a duty that they owe to their employees, but also people who may be coming to either, like in your case, our office or someone's store, a retail store or restaurant. Is that what we're talking about when we talk about premises owners?
Matt was referencing more of the owner, but I think for the topic of this conversation, we're really speaking more to the business owner, you know, not the landlord itself who doesn't have the day-to-day control, but for what are the business owners doing to protect the employees and their customers who are coming into their business. And so that was where what Matt was leading into about, you know, what constitutes reasonable care in terms of protecting people from contracting COVID in your establishment, you know. And so, you know, just the minimum basic things that the CDC is saying about having hand washing, you've got to have soap in the bathroom. You've got to have, following the CDC guidelines in terms of mandates for masks, making sure that when people are coming, they are wearing masks, that social distancing is being followed. But we've gotten to the point of even saying, you know, you have to provide appropriate signage in terms of directing people. What are your policies? What are you doing? And make it obvious, you know, so that it's easy for people to follow what your rules are in your business. So what Matt was suggesting was that we have actually put, you know, we've made one-way hallways within the business so that we're not passing directly facing each other when we're walking through the business. So we're only going one direction each way, and we're only using certain doors to exit and certain doors to enter. You know, we've got signs up about the fact that we need to wear a mask. If you're in your individual office, you don't have to wear, you know, with your door, you don't have to wear a mask in there. But if you're going out even into the hallways where you're going to be coming into contact with other people, then put your mask on, you know, wear that when you're walking around. And it's trying to establish what of those types of measures are necessary, you know, to say that you're doing something to prevent COVID from spreading in your business, to your employees, to your customers. And trying to make those things as obvious to people so that there's no question, like our business is on notice of the possibility that someone can contract COVID right now. I mean, and we think that notice is obvious. I mean, there's no way you can't be aware that this is out there, you know? So these bare minimum things of making sure there's masks, establishing some policies and making those policies known to your employees and your customers are absolutely going to be necessary.
How far do you have to go to sort of insulate yourself we'll call a premises owner, but we know where you're talking about business owners in that group. You know, some places, you know, where they have the signs, they have the stuff on the floor, like you talked about. Whereas if you go, you know, you go into some buildings, they're now installing those temperature takers where you put your thumbprint or you just simply lean into the little box on the wall. How is that standard of care established when it comes to something like this that we've not faced before?
Well, it's a very good question. I was reading an article right before we started with some public policy polling about how do people get information about COVID and how do they assess risk? And standard of care is really tied into the idea of risk and managing and assessing risk. So COVID is such a unique case because you've got two very, very disparate views of what's going on, especially now that things are starting to open up. You have on the one hand, people who are very concerned about the liability and mitigating the risk. And you have, on the other hand, people who are trying to get back to the new normal. So a perfect example are the major college football conferences. The Big Ten looks at the risk of myocarditis, the heart condition that some believe is associated with COVID. And they say that is just too big of a risk for us to play college football. We just can't do it this fall, and we'll try to do it in the spring, but there's a chance we might not be able to do it in the spring. On the other hand, you have the Southeastern Conference and the Big 12 Conference, and they're saying, look, we think the risk is manageable. The ACCs, the Atlantic Coast Conference's doctors are saying, we don't agree necessarily with the findings of the Big Ten's doctors, and you have this sort of battle of the experts as to what's required there. And so you have three of the major college football conferences want to play and two of them don't want to play. So coming back to this issue of standard of care, where you have such a split as to what's required, what's really the risk, how do you get COVID, and what are the best ways of preventing it, it really leaves you as a business owner, someone who's occupying space, and you have people from the outside coming in, it really puts you in a very difficult position as to what steps are required to mitigate this risk. I mean, the one that's sort of the classic case that I think we've all heard about was the air conditioning, where there were some folks in a restaurant, somebody had COVID, and then the air conditioning circulated the virus to the people in the restaurant. And, you know, how do you mitigate that? The idea is that standard of care is constantly evolving. So everybody is able to say water on the floor that you could slip on. It's an obvious risk. A smushed up green bean on the floor of the produce section.
You're killing those green beans, Matthew. You must have a thing against green beans.
It's actually the reason why I talk about green beans is that that's probably the most famous Maryland case on slip and fall. It's called, I think it's Mons versus Giant Food, if I remember. And that's what establishes what's called the quote unquote time on the floor evidence in the issue of notice. So it's pretty famous.
So let's go back to this football team example for a second and say, you know, I'm a kid, I'm at Clemson, right? And I'm playing football at Clemson. And not only am I playing football at Clemson, but I'm living in my dorm. I'm going out with my friends. I'm doing all the other stuff that we do because we have classrooms where we're actually going to classes at Clemson. And I don't know what they're doing. I'm just using this as an example. But and then I get sick. Or maybe it's worse than that. Maybe I can't play football again, or maybe I'm out of school for 6 months, or maybe worse. Maybe I pass away. Isn't there some need to be able to prove a link between actually being on the football field or practicing with your football team and whatever the injury is that the person sustains? And if there is, how do you prove that kind of a thing when it comes to a virus like this?
Well, it's a very good question, because that's one of the key pieces to proving a negligence case. That's what's called causation. And with regard to COVID, it's an incredibly difficult question because you're out and about in the community. So you could be playing football. Let's say you're at the University of Maryland. You could be playing football at one point. You could be in your dorm another point in time. You could be over at the Stamp Student Union having Chick-fil-A at another time. And, you know, in theory, you could contract COVID at any of those places. Maryland has long since recognized the idea of negligent transmission of an infectious disease. It's the famous BN versus KK case. That case was dealing with a sexually transmitted disease. And the idea of causation was pretty simple in that the plaintiff knew who she had been with and was able to establish that this was the person who gave her a sexually transmitted disease. And there was liability there. But when you're dealing with COVID, it's a little more difficult because it goes beyond just contact tracing. It goes to the where did you get it, not just who were you with, but where did you get it? And then it ties in with the issues we were just talking about with standard of care. is there, what is the standard of care that was owed? And then the breach of the standard of care. You know, Celeste, what do you think about that in terms of establishing, has there been a breach of the standard of care?
Well, and in addition to that, Maryland being unique in the fact that we have contributory negligence in our state. So that means basically that if you're in any way responsible for causing your own injuries, that you're entitled to no recovery whatsoever. So if you were to apply this to a situation with COVID and you have, if you've been told, you know, that you have to social distance and you have to wear a mask and you have to wash your hands, you know, you would have to prove that you were doing each and every one of those things. But if you've been, you know, to the student union and you've been on the football field and you've been in different classrooms and you've gone and hung out with your friends or you've gone to a protest or, you know, how are you going to show that it's not on the part of the person you're suing to show that you didn't do it. It would be on you, on your part to show that you didn't do anything else that could have possibly resulted in your contracting this disease.
So let me follow up. Let me ask you another question along those lines. So let's go back to our college athlete, right? And you know, I read the newspapers and my parents have said, you know, you do whatever you want to do. I'm 20 or 21 years old. I'm an adult by any measure. But I've decided I'm just going to play. I want to play. I want to be out there. Isn't there some, from an institutional perspective, if that illness happens, whatever there's that injury or damage that comes to me later, is there any defense based on, you know, I knew what the risk was, but I did it anyway.
Sure. I mean, you could be looking at some kind of assumption of the risk defense. There's contributory negligence. And contributory negligence in this case, which is sort of a unique creation, it exists in Maryland, it exists in Virginia, the district, I think North Carolina and Alabama. It's very, very limited. Most other states use what's called comparative negligence, where you're looking at the two sides compared to one another and determining, you know, who's more at fault for the injury. But under contributory negligence, the question could be, well, were you contributory negligent by going to that party or by being sort of out and about? Then you have what's called assumption of the risk, and it's sort of the cousin of contributory negligence, but it's not quite the same thing in that you're saying that you know what the risk is and you voluntarily confront that risk, and therefore you can't complain when something goes wrong.
From our perspective as being plaintiff's counsel, you know, we do plaintiff personal injury. We don't like these policies at all. You know, the assumption of the risk and contributory negligence, we're just like, no, 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 no.
Oh, for sure.
So the laws differ. The laws differ from one state to the other, just so that message gets through to folks, right? It may be different in Maryland versus Montana or Arizona or some other place.
No question about it. And the other thing that I'd point out is that if I remember correctly, what I've seen is that there's the issue of waivers. And can you sign something that gives away your right to sue for exposure to COVID. And I think I saw recently that the NCAA has said that that they're not going to allow schools to press their athletes to sign waivers to say, hey, you know, I want to play. I'll sign this document that waives my right to sue if I get COVID. So I think that's an issue that's going to develop.
What kid who's on a college campus who's an athlete? I mean, who doesn't want to play? I mean, it seems like that would raise other issues, I presume, in terms of the relationship between the school and the kid and that sort of thing. If they start shoving these waiver forms under people's noses, right?
Sure, and I mean, and also you have to look at the age. You know, we know that here at JGL, we created that unique class. That 18 to 21 year old class when it came to alcohol, which would be something interesting for another topic. But are those people really at a level where they should be being allowed to make that a decision? It's a life or death decision that they're making right there.
Indeed.
You know, and we've been able to limit their ability to make that decision with other things in terms of alcohol, you know? So, I mean, if you're talking about sending your kid away to school, you know, and he's like, well, I don't care, you know, my life could be over, I just have to play football. He's going to school to be more than just a football player, you know?
Sure.
So those waivers would be very, as a parent, I would be very concerned.
It sounds to me like, and tell me if I'm wrong, but the possibility of the courts being flooded with COVID-related lawsuits is significant. Are states or jurisdictions, states or the federal government on any level, doing anything to try to tamp down or limit these types of lawsuits?
Yeah, they absolutely have, because you're right. The risk is huge, and particularly with the college athletes, you know, there you see on Twitter and whatnot that some plaintiffs' firms are essentially ready to go, and that if somebody in one of these football conferences that are going to be full go, if somebody contracts COVID and has a significant problem, they're ready to you know, swing into action to bring a claim there. But there's issues here. There's both at the federal level and at the state level. So keep in mind that you have two different levels of court jurisdictions that overlap one another. And so you have issues with both the federal and the state level. The federal level, there really hasn't been much that has been done to date in terms of limiting COVID suits. Where they would have federal jurisdiction, or if the feds did what was called preemption, where they would essentially come in and try and create a law that would apply equally to all 50 states. So that's kind of a very complex, what's called choice of law issue that hasn't really been joined yet. That really hasn't happened yet. But at the state level, you have issues with both what are called third-party suits, where you're suing, you know, a third party, a somewhere where you are, somewhere where you've been, and you don't work there. You also have workers' compensation, because remember, workers' compensation suits for negligence against your employer is barred by what's called workers' compensation exclusivity. So some states have done different things. Utah, for example, out west, has passed a law providing immunity for all harm caused by COVID unless there is intentional or grossly reckless behavior. So that's a very high burden to meet. North Carolina, Oklahoma, Wyoming, they've also passed immunity statutes. North Carolina's law covers essential businesses like grocery stores, hardware stores, pharmacies, banks, restaurants, and even attorneys going to your law office. And North Carolina has gone even further than that to exclude gross negligence, recklessness, or intentional infliction of harm. So they've set a very high standard. Right now, there's nothing in Maryland, and there's nothing at the federal level. And another group of states have granted protection from liability to healthcare providers, because they want to encourage healthcare providers to stay open and stay active and treat people. For workers' compensation, the issue still exists as to how do you prove where you got it? Because you have to prove that your injury derived from your work. And proving that for COVID purposes is difficult, because for all the reasons we talked about before. So multiple states have passed legislation which creates what are called presumptions, where if you get COVID, it's presumed that you got it in the course of your work, and that would apply to certain classes of workers, especially emergency response workers and healthcare workers.
Yeah, and that was making me think about, you know, this immunity being such a slippery slope in terms of, you know, if the federal government, you know, if the Congress decides to grant immunity to businesses that if anyone gets COVID, it's not their responsibility. You know, what does that do in terms of these businesses taking some measures to protect people? You know, so that's very scary, you know, in order to say if they're given just blanket immunity, then they can just say, hey, our doors are open and we don't care. And anybody gets it, oh, well, you're on your own. Instead of, you know, it kind of does away with all of this, what is the standard of care arguments anyway, because it would be like, well, it doesn't matter because we're all immune to it. I hope that things don't go that way. I'd like to see that businesses will be caring towards their employees, towards their customers, you know, and want to take these steps, and people will keep washing their hands, wearing their masks, and, you know, we won't have to worry about, you know, what Congress does, because we'll all be worrying about what we're individually doing to protect each other.
Let me ask you an off-topic question, Celeste, just a little off the COVID topic. What's the dynamic between you and Matt? I know you guys work together. Do you folks, if someone...
He works for me.
He works for you. Yes, I get that. But how does it, you know, so if a client comes in, I'm going to ask people, people are going to know how to get a hold of you anyway, which we'll have you we'll tell them in just a moment. But what's the dynamic in terms of how the two of you work on a client's case, whether it's COVID related or automobile accident or a slip and fall, as Matt mentioned, or any other type of an action?
Sure. Well, Matt and I, we manage the personal injury department together. We have two other pre-litigation paralegals. Matt is the lawyer. I am the litigation paralegal, and we have two pre-litigation paralegals. So basically, you know, a client calls in and they're going to come in and meet with Matt, and a pre-litigation paralegal is going to get their case started. Pre-lit, basically, it's just what it means. You know, we'll handle everything up before a suit has to get filed. There's not a, you know, Matt is going to determine, is this case viable? I mean, do we think we can win? There's a whole team that's going to work together to handle the case, but more of the legwork that's done on the paralegals, and more of the theory of the case that's more on the attorney, and we're going to all work together to get the best result, you know, that we can.
And Celeste and Matt, if people want to reach out and give you, both either of you, a call to talk about a COVID related matter or any other type of personal injury matter, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you? Celeste, you first.
You call right in through the main switchboard, 301-220-2200, and they're going to put you right in touch with us.
I tell people all the time, I'm the most reachable person in America. So if you want to talk to me and you want to find me, there's no reason not to. Email, I always have my electronic lifeline to the mothership with me. So mfocht@jglaw.com. So two L's back to back. You know, email me, we'll get in touch with you, or call the number. Celeste and I are actually physically here in the Greenbelt office, and we're working with these sort of these guidelines and these protections that we've been talking about. So for whatever reason, if we need to see you in person, we can figure out a way to do that. Or we're actually doing a lot of our contact with our clients virtually, through Zoom, through you know, telephone, Microsoft Teams, all of those. We really have access to pretty much any way that we can be connected to our clients. We're using those tools, and it's working quite well, actually. And I don't think I think Celeste would agree with this. We haven't seen any drop off in terms of how we relate to the clients and how we're able to contact them.
Excellent. Thank you, Matt. Thanks, Celeste. Thank you both for joining us. This has been really illuminating. Hopefully folks got a lot of information from this. Thanks to everyone out there for listening in. Join us for our next episode. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.